Could you continue the black portion?
Many of the blacks were severing their support for Israel and for their connections with the Jewish community, especially true in the East and the Orient. You were beginning to get the parting of the ways between the Jewish lay leadership and the black lay leadership, which is a process which has deepened and continued to this very day.
What do you feel was the cause of that?
Some of it had to do with the fact that the opposition to Israel was becoming associated with non-whites in Africa and Asia, with the degree of Muslim infiltration in the American black community, and with the degree to which, in fact, Jews becoming ever more affluent and ever more conservative were disinterested in the economic phases of the civil rights movement. And I say disinterested because I don't want to say antagonistic.
Okay. What I really would like to know also, what your views are on the civil rights today in the labor movement?
Civil rights? Mm-hmm. Well, officially the labor movement has never deviated one inch from its civil rights commitments. The world is made up of an excessive amount of verbosity, and much of this commitment is verbal. In recent years, 5 or 10 years, has progressed remarkably, and then of course this is, I suppose, historically what happens. You start by enunciating a philosophy, and then it takes time for it to infiltrate into your actions. It has been a long struggle to get the practices of unions to conform to any reasonable standard of equal opportunity perceptions. And it's because the labor movement remains a fundamentally and very strongly democratic organization, the most significant democratic element in our community. There are no other power centers which are wholly dependent on their membership for survival, with no external influences that are meaningful. And that means that while leaders tend to be somewhat more sophisticated and broader, the rank and file tends to be more concerned with their immediate interests and their immediate ambitions and greed and fears and whatnot, and thus it is quite natural that the members of unions, like all other people, fear anything that competes with them or jeopardizes their jobs, their economic situation. And the fact that blacks were beginning to become assertive and indicate that they wanted things which really meant that there was an additional source of economic competition coming into the picture, led very inevitably and understandably to growth of tensions. Those who wanted what they didn't have were not enthusiastic about those who had it. Those who had it were not enthusiastic about those who wanted it, to the extent that this was viewed, and to some extent was in fact a threat to, or at least a potential threat to individuals, as it was. And it has taken a long time and a lot of societal influence and intervention, and of course the government, to produce the kinds of interventions that have become increasingly meaningful and have resulted in our making fantastic progress in the field of equal opportunity. The statisticians, to the contrary, notwithstanding.
Excuse me, Galvi, you wanted to ask
something? Well, I don't want to lose the flow, but you, as an aside, mentioned that the New York Jewish community was truly part of the community, whereas Pittsburgh Jewish community is not. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Oh, yes.
I have that right now.
Pittsburgh is, Pittsburgh Jewish community is a very sectarian, insulated, relatively isolated community. The trend is in that direction rather than reverse. There are no Lillian Friedbergs. David Shapiro is a very interesting fellow, and I admire him very much. I've known him as a child better than I know him now, but he doesn't rate with Saul Shapiro in terms of his identification with the community at large.
He's Saul's son.
Yeah, and I do not include sitting on the boards of directors of major banks and corporations as identification with the community. That's not the community I'm talking about. Perez said to me years ago that one of the things that Israel has done to American Jewish life has been to virtually push out its intellectual leadership and substitute for it those who have or can raise money. And Pittsburgh offers a very dramatic example of that. There are a few minor exceptions, maybe token exceptions. It is astounding the degree to which the Pittsburgh Jewish community is organized, is effective, is generous, and is unrelated to the general community. Personally, I consider it more than astounding. I consider it scandalous.
Do you have any knowledge of the Jewish home for the seniors?
I'm not talking about charity. I'm talking about the political, economic, and social problems of the community. I do not consider charity the effective way in which one relates to a community's needs.
Oh, most people pay at the Jewish home. No, I was just, there have been some difficulties there, and I was just curious whether you were aware.
Ben, may I ask you, is this unique to Pittsburgh, do you know, or other Jewish communities?
I don't know that much about Jews elsewhere. My just glancing at Jewish newspapers isn't right. I used to be all too familiar with Jewish newspapers, and that's what they were.
You mean Yiddish newspapers?
Yeah, I mean those newspapers which are produced by the Jewish community, such as our own. And every city has one. And those I've glanced at just casually when I've been in cities. Much more urban, much less sectarian, much more interested in the broad sweep of the communities. I consider it terribly offensive to read that what is important in Pittsburgh is what some Jewish person did or did not do. What's important in the world is Israel. There is nothing else that matters. An astoundingly sectarian view of a community. It would not bother me if this were a specialized characteristic or reflection of the Jewish community, which had broader interests and broader activities. but it is not specialized. It is comprehensive. There virtually is no Jewish interest. And interestingly enough, most of the Jews who do enter the broad Jewish community, the broad Pittsburgh community, usually do so in some considerable degree by departing from the Jewish community in terms of its leadership, in terms of its activities. I think the notion that the enormous resources and energies of this community should be spent dining for good causes is a historical irony, though it does provide a good basis for the women's dress shops.
Do you have any comments about Montefiore?
Yeah, I see no justification for Jewish hospitals.
You do not.
Or for Catholic hospitals.
So you feel that
that was the right thing to do?
Oh, sure. Okay. Now, whether I'm enthusiastic about the University of Pittsburgh monopoly is another matter. But if I'm not, it doesn't have anything to do with Jewish or not Jewish. It has to do with other things.
I'd like to ask you about your new career. You have a totally new career since we interviewed you in 1977. When did you start? When did you go with CMU?
Jesus, that long ago.
Yes.
I retired at the December 1, 1978. And I came to, I did lots of things for a couple of years. First 6 months, I spent more than 6 months helping my wife terminate her life, which was an engrossing activity. And about a year and a half after she died, I got myself turned around with all that her death meant, all that followed in terms of family and everything else. And then my meeting Sylvia, my current wife, that orientation, that was not easy. And thus it was at the beginning of 1980, I suppose, that I, or 81, that I hooked up with Carnegie Mellon. And this has been a very fortuitous circumstance, brought about only because Pitt is so awkward and bureaucratic. Pitt is where I wanted to go. And I don't know what it's like now. I don't know the new chancellor. Pazva even introduced me as a member of his faculty on occasion. He didn't know that the mere fact that he had so decided had nothing to do with what happened at Pitt. And quickly came to the conclusion that the impossibility of getting Pitt to do anything that it better drive me to this management school, engineering. I knew Dick Syard, and I knew pretty well the dean of SUPA, School of Urban Public Affairs.
Who was that dean?
Toby Davis, who served on my board Action Housing, of which I was president, and I decided to approach Dr. Syed, and after some unfolding of fascinating university politics, which is a good way to get inaugurated into the university life, there's no use getting overwhelmed with its academic characteristics. You may as well get to the important things, which are the political characteristics. We're just talking about a few months, but they were long months for me. Was offered a position as an adjunct professor, which I didn't want because I didn't want to teach. develop a labor studies center. And I therefore expressed my disinterest. Lunch one day, whereupon Toby, a very wise gentleman, said, "And I will give you the title of professor," whereupon I folded like a house of cards. I, with no education, without much technical knowledge, with no credentials being offered, the title of professor just astounded me. Splendid substitute for an education. So we quickly sealed that deal, and everything flowed thereafter. A few months later, Toby and Dick Syed and I talked about organizing a labor center. A year later, it was consummated with great difficulty because of the disinterest of the financial community and the overwhelming disinterest of the Jewish community, which by this time lost whatever traditions there had been, labor connections, even interests. And it used to be a fascinating era for me before I retired from the steelworkers to see the degree to which histogred activities found difficult in being related in this community to the community.
Ben, what is it that you started to teach? What were your courses? And
I've always taught labor relations.
Do you teach graduate students?
Only
graduate students.
This year, for the first time, I have a group of undergraduate students, and it is not only the first time but the last.
Why?
It's too much for me and doesn't interest me as much.
And your graduate students are getting degrees in what?
They get master's degrees in something relating to public policy. We have 3 degrees.
Which are?
Master of Public Management, which are the mid-career students. Master of Arts Management, which are public policy students interested in careers in the arts or who have careers in the arts. In arts management. Some of them are artists who want to develop management interests. And then the Master of Public of Science Management, public. We call it the MS degree, which is the bulk of our full-time students.
So you are enjoying teaching?
Oh, yes. I didn't think I would, but I have come to. I enjoy teaching a little bit, but I enjoy students tremendously.
You do.
And like everything else, you get... I've always latched on to the positive. That's my strength in life. That's why I live, I think. There are some people who worry endlessly about imperfections. I worry about opportunities. And if I can have 20 students, of whom 6 are impossible, 10 are irrelevant, and 4 are good, I'm pleased with the 4.
Ben, I was fortunate enough to be at your birthday party yesterday, and Lynn Williams was there. I'd like to hear a little bit about your association with Lynn Williams.
Lynn Williams came into office.
He's president of the United Steelworkers Union.
This is his last term, and he is retiring in March. On the heels of his, what historically may be the most remarkable year any union has ever spent, which the press of the nation of Pittsburgh doesn't know about, because there are no labor reporters left around to know anything. And if they do know anything, their editors are hostile to what they know, because who cares?
Who were good labor reporters?
Who were?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we used to have a lot of back. I forgot most of their names. One or two of them still alive. Abe Raskin is still hanging around. He's retired since the New York Times. Almost all of our labor report is gone. He retired, gone into other endeavors, died. Newspapers and magazines are disinterested in labor reports. They don't consider the beat, because following the inspiration of academia, they've decided that America alone in the world is not going to have a labor report.
Ben.
Statisticians give them the basis for this. Management is unaware of it because they are not statisticians. They don't know about who works for them.
Ben, November 17th, 1993, was the passing of NAFTA, and that is the North American Trade Agreement, and I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Well, the Sunday Press had Post Gazette had a rundown of labor reactions to this, and the outstanding leadership of Lynn Williams was demonstrated in an article. The most intemperate, there's some intemperate articles today too, inputs from labor leaders around, most of whom are headquartered in Washington, about NAFTA and what it means to the future of the world, and what labor's reaction is going to be, et cetera, and so on. That's a great contrast to the very sensible, measured observations by Lynn Williams, who now turns to the fact that the unions, his union will, and other unions hopefully will, turn their attention to seeing to it that the NAFTA era will be one in which the United States pays attention to the interests of workers here and to doing what we can do to advance the interests of workers in Mexico, as against others who are now deciding how their members are going to vote, since if they ever had any influence over how their members vote, which is unlikely, it's one of the great myths of our generation, my generation. I would doubt that they have that influence today. And the declarations I read now about how workers will not support Clinton, and they will do this and will do that because of NAFTA, displays a great concentration on Washington society and a lack of understanding of what goes on in America and among American workers and among the members of these unions, none of whom is in Washington.
So short term, what does NAFTA?
Well, it depends in some degree on Canadian leadership, which is much more progressive and realistic than ours and much more sophisticated. It depends in some measure on world economic factors, and it depends on how far and how long we will have this tremendous wave of domination of economic affairs by financial interests and not by management. Everybody talks about the waning influence of labor. The waning influence of labor is picayune in its importance, if it exists at all, as compared to the rapidly declining influence of management. Management is being relegated to the position of office boys. Financial interests are ruling the roost. Managers are the serfs of the financial interests. The degree of domination of authoritarian rule over managers compares with that which existed over workers in the pre-union era. People don't know this. Managers can't complain. If they complain, they're no longer managers. They complain to me. that's obviously on a very personal and confidential basis. And of course, any real in-depth view of what is going on demonstrates the fact that managers are all on a short leash. They come and go, including CEOs, a new phenomenon in America. And much depends on the degree to which decision-making is in the hands of these basically global interests, because managers, financial interests, have no nation, they have no nationality. And we will see in the coming year or two how this shapes up. It is not going to shape up simplistically. Things rarely do. You will not find NAFTA a source of great benefit to America. You will not find it a source of great detriment to America. You will find that it changes some of the decision-making factors in various ways. And the strains and stresses that go into this are so many and so complex and so almost unidentifiable that it is folly to say this is what's going to happen.
So there's a lot, that's sort of the long term.
2 or 3 year term. This nonsense we went through, we're going to have X number of additional jobs, we're going to lose X number of additional jobs, based on what I used to do for a living. I mean, my union told me what the policy was, and I went out and produced all of the learned and impressive data and statistics to prove it. And if the policy changed tomorrow, I changed the statistics. That's easy enough to do, and that's what we do. We are in an era in which we no longer worship money. What we worship now is statistics. And some of the statisticians even think that they know what they're doing, which is the ultimate sin. We don't have any answers to any of these things. And the only answers that will evolve are those which come from experience. What will happen within Mexico? We don't know. What will happen to health care? Health care will have great influence on our relationship to other countries. There's a fantastic cost item that will go in one direction or another, or maybe neither. We don't know yet. That's going to have a tremendous influence on everything.
Do you think Hillary Clinton has had some impact, or do you think her plans?
Yeah, she's had some impact. I think the administration may have turned out to rush too quickly again in response to our financial, the strength of our financial community into deals with the insurance companies, which are of no value to the country or to the health system. Are supposed to be of value to the political outcome, and we'll see whether that is so. The plan produced is a fascinating plan, supposed to be realistic politically. That's its major strength, and we will see whether it is. The irony of small business community, through a very minor portion, influenced in a great way along with the insurance companies that are relatively disadvantaged. These are things which the great political analysts and manipulators who are in this administration perhaps overlooked or didn't expect. I didn't expect them. Of course, I didn't expect anything. I don't know what's going to happen until it happens. But we have the phenomena of the administration having made a deal with a big insurance company and with the big traditional companies, a deal very much needed, and thinking that would kind of take care of that side of the ledger. And we're beginning to find out that the whole simplistic view of the world is outdated. And the small businessmen who probably shouldn't be in existence because they can't pay decent wages, can't provide for employees, so they can only live by exploitation. And I doubt whether our society should tolerate this.
Do you consider our minimum wage a decent wage?
No.
You don't think it's enough?
No.
What is minimum wage today? $4.25 or what?
It's more than that, but
not more, much more than that.
Well, what an adequate wage is depends on what people are willing to work for. We're not about to repeal economics. The question of the minimum wage is of very, very little significance. The question is, are we prepared to have a declining standard of living in America? We've had it now for 10 years, and my God, no, it's for 20 years. I'm getting older than I think. And I'm not saying that after you've gone through the dizzying growth and expansion of the post-World War II era, you're not entitled to a relapse or a relaxation, whichever you want to call it. But there's a question as to how long this society wishes to be a declining society. And the minimum wage is a very, very small piece of this, of very little significance. We cannot forever cover ourselves with the continuing reference point.